Hello and welcome to the award-winning Canine Hooper's World podcast. Everyone's invited. Hello everybody and welcome to another episode of season 4 of Canine Hooper's World podcast. Now, advance warning, my voice is still broken. It could break at any point and I will either squeak or sound really dodgy. One of those two things is likely to happen, but hopefully it will hold out. Today we are over the pond and I'm gonna admit it right now, I'm fangirling hard because this trainer is a massive inspiration to me and also to a lot of other trainers I know. Sarah, how are you?
Oh, I am great. Thank you so much for having me on, and no need to fangirl at all. That's just gonna make me blush and stutter a whole bunch.
Oh my God, I'm sorry, but I was literally, so little dog training confession. When I sent the message on Facebook, I was like, will you come on the podcast? When you said yes, I literally squealed.
Oh yeah, I'm glad I could make your day with just that simple of a thing.
Yeah, you just said yes. And I was like, woo, amazing. Okay. So for the people that don't know you, who are you? What do you do?
Yeah, so my name is Sarah Bruski. I am a dog trainer over here in the United States. My background is kind of a mishmash of everything, but the biggest notable pieces are I started in agility with Great Danes and then decided I needed a hardy Brit. Yeah, that's right, a Great Dane. Yeah, I did agility with Great Danes momentarily. and then my mentor at the time's like, you know, you really need a dog you can put a mock on, because the Danes were a little reactive. They had some behavioral things that we had to walk through or work through. And so I looked for a rescue and I found my Border Collie mix Zuma, and she is absolutely amazing. And so from there, I kind of got hooked in a variety of sports with her and then an Australian Coolie Zynga that I brought over when she was a puppy as well. And so we got into disc, and that's kind of where things just started spiraling out of control. we started competing in disc, we started traveling to compete in disc, and then pretty soon Purina was looking for a trainer at Purina Farms in Missouri to do performances every single day. And so I tried out for it, I auditioned, I interviewed, did the whole thing, and for some reason they decided to hire me, and the rest is history after that. For that job, I had to acquire a significant number of dogs. Highly recommend not getting as many dogs as I have, but they are hard workers, and to help save the bodies and the minds of the dogs I did have at the time, it made sense to add the ones that I did. And so we would just perform for the public every single day, and we got to train pretty much anything we wanted to train, which is really great. And so I got to dabble in a bunch of things. It was my full-time job just to train my own dogs. And I'd be like, hey, let's add scent work to our shows, or let's do this crazy diving dog trick that nobody's ever done. Like, let's try all this really cool stuff. And so basically I lived in a dog training laboratory for 8 years. And that's what I did, is I just trained whatever I wanted to train. And I did some rescue and some fostering and stuff like that. And I still do. But now I teach mostly online. I'm a dog sport coach, I like to say. I stole that term from Pat Stewart over at Canine Paradigm. And I just help dog sport teams wherever they are, online or in person, kind of try to get to the best that they can be in whatever sports that they're playing.
Amazing. So how many dogs are you at the moment?
Yeah, I have 10. It's too many.
No, but it's like the low end of double figures. It's a nice round number. Like 10 just sounds like a nice number.
Yes, it is. It's a nice number. And the big part is that, especially now that I have a little human child.
Yes, you have a youngling.
With her, most of my dogs are retired now. So I have 5 dogs in the double digits of age. And so they're just happy and content with laying on the couch and going for walks every day and occasional swim. And every now and then I throw a frisbee for them again. And they are just stoked about that sort of thing. Mm. So I only have 3 dogs that I'm currently training and competing with. Mm-hmm. So I have Creature, my 6-year-old Malinois, and he is a Mondeo Ring level 3 dog. And we are just going to start beefing up for competition season once again here. And we have about 2 feet of snow on the ground right now. So hopefully that melts. Yeah. And then I have Vibrant, who is an Australian Coolie that was bred by my breeding program. Mm-hmm. And she is just starting her agility career. She also does nose work and diving dog as well, and Frisbee. Not so much Frisbee. She's not very naturally talented at it. So I'm having to put a little bit more work than I'd like to into that. And then I have Cake, who is my 8-month-old Australian Coolie, who is just a baby dog right now.
Cool. So just quickly, Coolies are one of those dogs that in the UK we don't see in the wild very often. I'm sure I've seen one at like a breed thing, you know, where you go. So over here we have a thing called Discover Dogs, where like basically all the breeds are. You can see all the breeds, which is a really great way for people to kind of go, oh, I like that. And then they meet in person and go, oh, that's bigger or smaller or wider or hairier than I thought it was going to be. What are Coolies like? Because in my brain, I have like a short-haired herding breed.
Yeah, so they actually can be any kind of appearance. So there is no written physical standard for them. There is just a working standard. So they can be long coated. So Vibrant's long coated, and they can be pretty much any color under the sun. We don't typically see brindle is the only thing, but they are an older herding breed from Australia. The fable goes that back in the day when the herding breeds were just developing and the German immigrants were moving down to Australia, they had a merle breed called the German Tiger that they used to create their generic herding dog that they used. And then they said that the solid colored dogs were called Kelpies and the merled ones were called Coolies. And so they were the same breed at some point. And then at some point about 150 years ago, 200 years ago, they split off into their own breeds. Mm-hmm. So Kelpies tend to be a stronger eyed herding breed, kind of like a Border Collie. Yeah. They're more intense in that way. And Coolies are typically an upright herder and louder, and they are just goofy. So they back the sheep like Kelpies do, but they tend to be more pushy and more just kind of loud. And they're just hilarious dogs, and they're very independent thinkers. And they're just great. I always say that they're a mixture of basically a sight hound, a terrier, and a little bit of herder mixed in there.
I mean, it's not really a breed for the faint-hearted though, is it? Want to be doing something with that dog. This is not a couch ornament that is just going to sit on the sofa all day and then go for a little walk around the block and then
No, so just like a Border Collie really needs and thrives off of having a job to do, so do the Coolies. And then I always say, even people who do sports with their dogs, mm-hmm. you have to really like the training side of the sport versus the trialing side of the sport, because they are wicked smart and are always looking for shortcuts. So the biggest thing that people struggle with them is, you know, in Frisbee dog, we have a very predictable timer. It counts down 10, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, time, and then you leash up and you're done. Well, the Coolies hear 10 and they're like, bye, I'm not coming back because I don't want my turn to be over. And so like you're constantly trying to stay like two steps ahead of them to prevent these issues. Okay. And so a lot of times when people have them and they rush into trialing and they don't do all of that prep work, they are pretty frustrated very quickly.
But this is the thing, is that I think that comes with a lot of dog sports though, is that people are rushing to do the sexy stuff. And like my mantra is, it's just the foundation's done well. Like you need good foundations, you need solid foundations. And if they're not, obviously with the sport I do, hoopers, we're going for more kind of distance handling. Not everyone distance handles, but for me with my German Shepherd, I distance handle because I can't run that quick. That's just stupid. If my foundations aren't good and solid, he's not going to handle the way I need him to. He's not going to drive out the way I need him to. He's not going to have the forward focus I need him to. And it just kind of, is this something you come across a lot, that maybe, I don't know if it's just people new to sports or if it's just a kind of broad paintbrush, but some people really don't seem to get that foundations are so important.
Yeah, foundations are the most important thing. And lucky for me, it's one of my favorite things to teach is foundations and breaking behaviors down. But you're right, there's a lot of people that just want to jump to the fun stuff. But if we look at social media, for example, what are we sharing? You know, we're sharing the fun stuff, the good stuff, the sexy stuff, the stuff where our dog is always right. And I'm definitely guilty of this as well. And a lot of people aren't showing the foundation stuff because it doesn't get the likes, it doesn't get the appreciation, it doesn't get that reinforcement for the person sharing. So I always try to share as much foundation stuff as possible, because to me, that is the sexy stuff. Like, does your dog respond to a marker cue if you use multiple markers. Like when you say get it, do they light up because they know you're going to be throwing it and acknowledge that verbal cue is different from maybe your yes? You know, to me, that's like the best moment ever is, oh my goodness, they are listening to my words and understanding what it means.
Yeah.
And then like, you know, verbal cues. So Cake and Vibrant are really focusing on verbal cues alone for agility. Like when I say loop, which means wrap to the left, is that different from their wrap to the right? And are they able to acknowledge that no matter what my body is saying? Mm-hmm. Like, is that verbal cue overriding that? But, you know, like you said, everybody wants to get the fun stuff. But there are some dogs, I would argue, that once they have that foundation, they don't need as much maintenance.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of dogs, and I think, and I'm, you know, I'm sure there are exceptions to this rule, but there are definitely like border collies tend to, once they've learned something, they know that thing and it seems pretty solid. And there's not as much maintenance that has to go into it for them, or at least the border collies I've had experience with.
Yeah.
Versus, well, and also that also goes for if they learn it wrong. Well, now you're SOL too. Yeah,
exactly. Be careful what you look for.
Exactly. The coolies though tend to not do so well with repetition. Like they don't want to do the same thing over and over again. If they do it too many times, they're like, well, cool, I'm going to go find something else to do, or I'm going to come up with a creative way to do this because obviously this isn't working for you.
Yeah.
And so that's the big difference for them. My class, like when I do handling class with Vibrant, if I have to repeat a sequence, I'm going to change the beginning so that she doesn't think we're doing the same thing again, because she's just going to be like, yep, nope, I'm going to go do something else because obviously this wasn't good enough for you the first time we did this. And so it's just kind of being aware of that difference with them, which is, mm-hmm. you know, it took me a few of them to figure that one out.
I've found that as well recently, especially with teaching workshops more where we're kind of, I'm working with dogs that are more advanced. So we're setting up like sequences or full courses rather than kind of starting at the start really. And if the dog nails the course, like stop there.
Yes.
Because you know, if you ask them to go and do that course again, they're going to go.
Or they're just going to do it out of patterning and you're not going to learn anything out of it.
So this is the other thing in Hoopers quite often, especially when we're judging, and it's for speed of getting through the classes and getting through the dogs. We keep the layout the same and we change the numbers.
Yeah.
So having a dog that patterns is really hard. I've had it before with Dodge one day. He went wrong on the first course. And then the second course, he just completely ignored my cue and then did the first course perfectly. Obviously, that wasn't what I wanted. I wanted him to, and I literally stood in the middle of this course, not saying anything, not doing anything, as he ran the whole pattern without me, while the judge, who's, shout out to Becky, was literally crying with laughter as my dog just did everything beautifully in the wrong direction. And I was like, are you serious? And part of me was so proud and part of me was so pissed.
Like, buddy, I know it looks the same, but we're not doing the same thing, I swear.
Yeah. Do you find that when you're teaching, like if the dog nails it and gets it right, you literally want to stop, end on that high and throw a party?
Yeah, absolutely. So with my dogs, I have a pretty hard and fast, if they get it right twice in a row, maybe three times, if I'm like, I'm not really convinced that you know this thing, we're going to either stop and be done and work on something else, or we are going to push the criteria if that's the next step in our training plan. But I am a huge one for not wanting to stay at one spot for too long and work on the same thing for too long, because pretty soon they're going to think that that is the ultimate behavior and that's the end goal for that behavior. And not only that, but man, I'm a lazy trainer. I've got 10 dogs. Like, I don't want to put in 15 reps of the same thing. Mm-hmm. I get bored with it. Yeah. And so typically I rely a lot on latent learning. So two reps, two good reps at whatever stage I'm at, and then I'll let them sleep on it and come back to it the next day. And lo and behold, those two solid, great reps solidified in their brain. And now they have a really good understanding of that part of the behavior, wherever that part is. Mm-hmm. Now I can build on that with the next level of criteria or the next step in that, or I can start generalizing it or whatever the next part is in that progression. But yeah, absolutely. They get it right, we're done. We're going to do something else for sure. Cool.
I think as well, latent learning is one of those kind of things that I think when I was doing like pet dog stuff, it was kind of spoken about a little bit, but now I'm doing more sports stuff. It's something that is much more prevalent. And also I think it's used a lot more, even just things like when we have days where we're at a trial, so we're at a show and sometimes the grades will run in groups. So literally we'll do a run and then have maybe 20 minutes till the next run, then 20 minutes till the next run. I noticed by the fourth run, he's getting more and more tired. Whereas then if we're doing exactly the same the next day, he kind of comes out first couple and is like, yeah, let's do this. Whereas if we've had a lot longer in between runs, say two or three grades in between, he kind of, I don't know if he's, it's a mental rest as well as a physical rest. It's not that he's not fit enough. It's a 30 second run. It's nothing really. But I think it's that mental thing of he's kind of processing what we've just done, as well as kind of going, oh, okay, let's do another one. But I'm kind of still thinking about the one we just did.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. I could absolutely see that. I know with Vibrant, she has arousal issues. This is one of the reasons why she will never be bred. She's getting spayed in a month because her inability to manage her own arousal is a big thing. And for her, I really had to do a lot of work. Again, handling classes, right? You're doing probably four runs in an hour, and they might be shorter sequences. They may not be full courses or whatever, but she's having four separate turns. And I don't think she was ever fully coming down from the high of each one, even though I was doing, you know, arousal management stuff and scatter and snuffle mats and everything, and taking her for walks and everything else. I don't think she was able to come all the way down between those runs. And so for her, it was, okay, we're going to do two of the four turns. Maybe I'll run a different dog or I'll just skip them. And then we started doing three of the four runs. And just now, like, we can get through a full hour class and she is just as good on that fourth run as she is the first one.
Yeah.
But I mean, it was a while there where she would just hit the floor running. Her pupils were dilated. She's already panting and we haven't moved. And I'm just like, dude, like, you need to zen out, man. But I just noticed the other day, I'm like, hey, I don't have to skip runs anymore. Like, and she doesn't have to go back to the van to take breather breaks or anything. Like, she can just hang out for class. And there's a lot of work that went into it, but some dogs just really kind of struggle with those back-to-back things.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things I do with Dodge at training is he goes to the van. Couple of reasons. One is for his arousal levels, but also he is very, very dog selective. And if we're now in a group where it's all male dogs, so he does not need to meet any of the other boys. That's not a thing. Yeah. So it's just easier and safer for everyone for him to just be popped in the van, out the way. He can snooze for a bit, and then we come out and do our next run. Like, that's cool. But I think especially when you're kind of away competing, it's easy to forget how tiring it is for the dogs, isn't it, when you're out doing the competition stuff.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, there's always gonna be people that say that crating out of vans and not in the building has its risks, and it absolutely does. Like, there's no way about that. However, I think if you have a really good van setup, you know, a temperature monitoring device, you're out there with your dogs, checking on them frequently, and they make sure you have water and good ventilation and everything, you have your fans and all that set up. I think that having that quiet, safe place that looks the same as when you are training. So if your dog is used to being in the van and it's a relaxing place for them, having that safe house is a really good way to go about it, where they can really truly turn off, especially younger dogs or dogs that might be stressed out. And even if they don't even show a reaction, but maybe they just don't like being around other dogs. I got plenty of dogs like that, right?
Yeah.
They're cool with their friends, but they don't really want to see other dogs. They don't want to be friends with other dogs.
If you've just described Dodge perfectly.
Like, that's just, they're cool. Bag. They live with 10 dogs, man. They're cool. Like, they're social out. So I'm a huge fan of just creating that out of the van. And I mean, most of the times I have a young dog or a puppy with me, and I don't want to bring in four crates every time I trial. Like, it's just not a thing I want to do.
Also, you're then not there to supervise what those other three dogs are doing. While you're running that one dog, you'd much further in the van, they're chilling. Oh, we're in the van today. Cool. We go in the van every day. This is normal for us. Like, it's that little safe hub. Obviously, as well in the UK, the main concern is whether the van's going to get soaking wet and covered in rain rather than it being too hot.
Right.
We don't really have the heat thing very often. If we do, like, the car park just looks like it's full of spaceships because there's literally like silver sheets over everything.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
And see anyone, like a plane flies over and I'm sure they'd like the pilots are getting blinded from the reflection.
So luminous.
Dog show down there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you think that people kind of expect dogs that are competing to always be kind of, I don't know, like friendly? And I'm doing that in inverted commas, because I know for me personally with Dodge has big emotions. I don't like the word reactive because I feel that every animal reacts. He just has big emotions and he's a shitbred German Shepherd, to be honest. He was not bred for a good solid temperament, I can tell you that much. He has his friends, he has his little circle of his girls, he has his little harem. A competition, my goal for him is to just be neutral. I don't want dogs approaching us. I actually muzzle him when we're at venues now, because people give you a lot more room when your dog has a face fence on, which is great. Yes. Especially he's got bright orange ones, so you can see it a mile off as well, so no one has an excuse.
Right.
But I do feel that a lot of people put their dogs in situations where when they're queuing, they're so tight together and they're walking so close to each other. And you're like, you kind of wish that we would just go back to social distancing at dog shows, right?
Yes, 100%. Oh my God. I think that actually in the grocery store all the time. I think that pretty much everywhere. I was a huge fan of 6 feet, please, 6 feet. I 100% agree with that. I really think it has to do with the sport and the community. So up here in Minnesota, the agility community is fantastic about not having dogs go up and say hi. If they do want to interact, they always ask first and they give you the benefit of the doubt and the plenty of space. It's like, it's just the normal here. Down in St. Louis, it was a little bit more... like they wouldn't let their dog go say hi, but they weren't as bubbly about your space. Mm-hmm. So like Famous, my Malinois, when we would trial in AKC agility, she was very uncomfortable with other dogs like behind her, as well as coming up into her space. She never was reactive, but she just got nervous about it. And it's just who she is. She doesn't like other beings in her space and new environments and that type of thing.
I mean, we've all been in that queue at the grocery store where someone stands too close to you and you're like, can you please?
Yeah. So, and just back up, for her, the big thing was that she trusted that I would keep her safe. Right. Mm-hmm. And there were some moments where I couldn't, like a Weimaraner literally just walked right into her butt and she's like, excuse me. I'm like, that they had plenty of space. I assumed they were going to go around and they didn't. So that was a thing. And then the disc dog community tends to be more like all our dogs should be friends. And I think it has to do with it's a more laid back sport generally. And again, this is going to be regional. Some clubs are not this way at all. Mm-hmm. They just want to play Frisbee with their dogs. And it's more of a weekend thing for a lot of them. And a lot of them have dogs that are super social. They go out to demos and stuff like that. And they're, playing at parks all the time. So they're used to having their dogs off leash, running around and interacting with everybody. But it makes it really difficult for if you have a dog that is reactive or selective or whatever words you want to use, because now you have to be so vigilant, right? And then your vigilance becomes nerves at some point. You get a conditioned emotional response when you see that, and then that travels right down the leash. And so it can be really, really hard, especially if you're new to those sports, to be able to stand up and be like, hey, my dog doesn't actually like this. And putting yourself out there in that way. So I feel for those people that are like, I'm not sure if my dog would be okay with this or if in not being able to say anything about it. I just say stuff.
And this is the thing, isn't it? Because a lot of people are like, I don't know, either like embarrassed or worried to sort of go, my dog needs space. Whereas I'm literally like, look, you'd much prefer that I shout at you than he shouts at you. So let's just get that done with. And it's cool. And one of the things that appealed to me with Hoopers in the UK, and not all the organizations, but the majority of them, have a yellow dog system. There is written in the rules, if dogs wearing yellow, give them extra space, whatever. But also a lot of them have a 2 meter rule around the fence. So we don't have dogs on the ring fence ever.
That's awesome.
It's like not a thing. To be fair, I'm really lucky. Last week I was competing and my voice was completely broken. And I know the judge that was in the ring next door, it was agility literally next door. And he saw me come in and held his ring for a minute just so Dodge could do his run without a dog running, which I was very appreciative of. He can run with dogs running next door, but I prefer to have full vocal range in those situations.
Yeah, exactly.
More worried about a dog jumping in the ring our side than him leaving the ring kind of thing, you know, because if a bitch jumped in the ring, it would probably be okay. But if like another entire male came in, that's not going to be a situation I really want to deal with.
That's a hard situation, yeah.
Right? And he's not the sort of dog that anyone could just dive in and help either. Have a shepherd, seriously. I'm starting to rethink my life plans, but you know. But that was one of the things that appealed to me with Hoopers, is that there were kind of things in place for dogs that needed a bit more room and a bit more space. You know, there's a yellow queue, people aren't leaning on the fence, but also you can go in the ring and just go, guys, can everyone just move back? And people are like, yeah, cool, no problem.
Yeah.
I did have a lady one day, she said it, I'd walk past, and she said it to one of the other people that competes with me. Well, if a dog's that bad, why is it on the showground?
Mm. That's because she hasn't had a dog like that yet.
Right. And I was like, and actually the lady, she turned around and stuck up for me, and she was like, if you knew the time and effort that had gone into that dog, and you watch that dog do his run and watch him win his first place, maybe just be a little bit kinder.
It's one of those things where like it's so easy to be outside of it and be judgy. I mean, okay, me as a first-time parent here, there are so many things that out from the outside I was like, man, well, just keep your house picked up, it's not that hard. I am so glad you cannot see my house right now, because it is that hard. It is that hard, right? And so unless you are in those shoes walking that walk, you just don't know. And so she just hasn't had that experience in her dog training journey yet. And even if she may have helped other teams through that, or maybe she's a dog trainer, she has reactive clients, if you have not had your own personal dog have those type of issues, you don't know what it's like living with those issues yet. And so I wish people would just keep some of their opinions more to themselves in that regard, and give people the benefit of the doubt that the dog is safe, everything is safe, but accidents still can happen, and it's much better to just avoid those situations than find yourself in a situation trying to make it right again.
Exactly that. And it's one of the reasons now why, you know, I pop his muzzle on, because everyone's safe. Because also, like you said, the anxiety starts happening in me, which then travels to him, and then because he's a shepherd, then he has to protect me, because obviously I'm his mama and he has to protect me, you know, that situation. You're like,
right, I had that same issue. The reason I muzzle Creature now on all of his drawing runs and sledding and everything, because we do those at a public park, but it's not a busy public park. Like, there's one parking lot, you can see if there are people there. None of the neighboring dogs go into this park or anything like that. They groom the trails for us to sled our dogs on. But there was one time where I had him and my other Malinois hooked up, I think it was to the sled or the bike, I don't remember. And there was this gentleman walking his, and we had told him, because we saw him walking, we were like, hey, just letting you know, we're doing the sport. So if we come up to you, we'll slow down if you can just make sure your dogs are on leash and you have them. He's like, yep, no problem. Okay, great. So we're going, and then I see them ahead. So I stop my dogs, I pull off the side, put them both in downstays, and he drops the leash for two of his dogs. And they come running up, and I've got Creature. Luckily he had a head halter on, because I knew that that he was walking back there, I might need that. So I've got him up by his head halter, keeping his mouth shut. And then Famous is in a downstay far away, and I put her behind us. And then they are coming up to Creature, and I'm like, no, like, this is not a safe situation. Like, Creature, he's not a safe dog with other dogs. Like, he can work around dogs, no problem. If your dog even walks by him, he's 100% safe. But if they're coming up into a space, like, he's not going to be okay with that. Like, he is a bred to fight, like, for protection sports. Like, he he enjoys fighting. He doesn't care what he's fighting with.
Biting, like, is reinforcing for him.
Biting is everything. Fighting is even better. Like, if the thing doesn't even want to be bit, like, that's the best, right? And so I've got his mouth shut, he's safe, but this dog's coming up and doing jabby bites at him now. And so me, I put my foot out to block the dog, and the guy's yelling, he's like, why are you kicking my dog? I'm like, I am literally saving your dog's life right now. Like, can you please come get your dog?
Just for the listeners, my eyebrows are so far up my forehead right now, they've disappeared into my hairline. Like, The actual. Like,
if I am not blocking your dog, and I didn't kick the dog, I was blocking the dog. I'm like, if I'm not doing this, your dog is not going to survive this interaction. So I'm like talking calmly because I'm trying to show creature I've got control of the situation. He comes up and then he fully realizes, I think, the extent of the situation. And he immediately apologized. And he's like, I'm so sorry. And so, like, if creature would have been muzzled in that situation, that dog would have been 100% safe, right? Unless the muzzle popped up or something like that. And so from now on, I just muzzle him because I never know when somebody's going to accidentally drop the leash. Like, it wasn't his fault. He didn't know. It's not like he planned on dropping the leash. He saw us. He put his dogs on leash like we had told him. And then it just happened that way. And so accidents happen. And you can be fully prepared for it as much as you can be. But, you know, you just never know. You just never know.
And don't you think as well, like when, like last night, prime example, we were walking Dodge. It was dark. My husband was with me. When my voice has been bad, Dale's been helping me walk Dodge because obviously I have no vocal communication with the dog. And honestly, he's literally gone, Mummy can't use her dog trainer voice. Wicked. And I'm like, okay, but can you listen a bit? And he's like, no, I cannot. No, you don't mean it. Because you're not using that voice, so you don't mean it, so I can do what I want. So Dale was with me and we were having a really good walk. We had a fox run out in front of us, which he didn't kick off at. He kind of went, oh, what was that? And then went, oh, it was a fox. Okay, fine. Saw a couple of other dogs, good as gold with them. And then there was a guy walking down the road on the opposite side and I was kind of just watching Dodge and he literally came in front of me and almost did a middle position, but whilst walking in front of me. Mm-hmm. And then he started growling and I was like, what the... The guy had left the pavement and had decided to cross the road towards us. So you have a muzzled German Shepherd in the dark and your life choice was to walk towards said muzzled German Shepherd.
Probably had a German Shepherd of his own at some time, but his was probably 120 pounds.
And was probably from one of those really cute show lines that are relatively friendly and like, you know.
Yeah.
And literally, I was like, I mean, fair play. Dale was just like, good boy, bud. And then I could see the guy was looking even more confused because we're praising the dog for growling. And I'm like, he is warning. Warning is good.
This is
a good step.
This is good,
He's not popping at you. He's not on his back legs trying to, like, grab you because he can't eat you. And I almost, and the guy was really staring at him. I don't know if creature's the same, but Dodge, like, if people just ignore him, he's cool. If people stare at him, it's like they push his anger button and he has to go, don't look at me. And you're like, okay, but do people look at you because you're quite good looking? But you can't get mad at them for looking at you.
Yeah.
But it was just a really weird situation. But again, you know, was it preventable? I'd done all my health and safety risk assessments.
Right.
Clearly strange man decided walking towards the
shrine. Yeah. Those are moments where I'm grateful to have a big, powerful dog at my side, to be honest, because if I'm traveling and it's me by myself, like I want creature to be aware of his surroundings, but then I can assess that. Right. So if I'm like, okay, this guy, I don't know what his deal is, but he's not really stopping, I can put creature in a contact heel, so now creature has a job to do rather than just stare down this gentleman. Or I can put him in a down stay and actually confront the guy and be like, hey, can I help you with something? Because that shows creature, not only is it giving creature a job to do, he's got his down stay, but it shows him that I am confronting the situation for him. And so I really liked that approach with creature. He is, I think, in a world where creature was given to me when I was a younger trainer and I wasn't as capable or aware of his potential back then, I think he could have been a very dangerous dog in situations like that. But because I've never ever given him even a glimpse of a inclination that I don't know what's going on 100% of the time in the world, I think he's really trust me to handle those situations. And I'm very grateful that he does that because he could be a very dangerous dog in those situations.
And that's the thing, isn't it? I think with the, again, it's a big, broad paintbrush, but I feel with the Shepherds, this has been the learning curve for me with Dodge, because up until now, you know, I grew up with Collies, and Shepherds in the 80s were not the same as Shepherds now. I'm sorry, but they were not. They just weren't. And the Chihuahuas, and we've just recently lost our Bull Breed girl, but they were just so easy, like just mm-hmm. the easiest things. And then I got my creature and like he's turned everything upside down. But also I did learn very quickly that if I'm not confident in a situation, he goes, right, okay, I have to look after mum. And I'm like, but mm-hmm. dude, I'm meant to be looking after you. And he's like, yeah, but you're... So I joke that like we've become each other's emotional support animals.
Yeah. Absolutely.
that's just yeah. our position. Like equally, we're each other's support animals. And that yeah. is where we are in the world right now. So with creature, your creature actually called mm-hmm. that. Love that. I just want to say with your Facebook retrieve challenge thing you did a few weeks ago, I had to put a sock up because I just had to see Creature get a sock because that was he's like so the ultimate Harry Potter reference. Right. I was like, of course he's going to be able free to pick creature. Up a sock. Like, now he's free.
Now he's free.
I'm sorry. I just sorry.
That was a good one. I appreciate
your,
that
your
one.
Mally elf is now free. I'm sorry.
He's now free. He doesn't think he's free though. Like he is such a mama's boy. It's ridiculous.
I mean, that's probably a good thing though, right? So with Mondio, it's one of those sports that I feel is really misunderstood. We've got a really cool Mondio club over here, Open Gate, that Bryony Cole runs. Bryony, if I don't know if Bryony listens, but I just want to say huge congratulations to her because she just got her Mondio one and she's the first female UK handler to
Heck
do
yes.
that. So that's awesome. Like... amazing. Soul's wicked. She's put so much work into him, like it's amazing. But I feel like protection sports over here have got a real stigma to them, and I feel that they're quite frowned upon by some of the kind of more positive reinforcement trainers. And I understand that a lot of trainers within security sports use aversives, and it makes me sad that if you're then wanting to do a kind of security-based sport, IPO, Mondio, French Room, whatever, you're kind of getting lumped in with the trainers that are maybe, you know, whose ethics don't align with your own. Is it kind of like that in the States, or does everyone just kind of get on and just train their dogs and get on with it?
Most people just get on and train your dogs. And so... it's going to be regionally based and club based, right? And there's always going to be people who are insecure with their own training. And so they lash out at other people's training, mm-hmm. right? So that's the main thing. However, as a whole, Mondio Ring has been ridiculously open to my style of training and adapting. And most of the people are excited about the things that I've been doing, and a few of us other more R plus type of trainers are doing with our dogs, because it's just always exciting to find a new thing, right? And every time there's a new thing in agility, everybody's like, "Ooh, have you done this weird cross thing, right? Or just German turn or whatever it might be." Like, yeah. It's always fun to learn new things. And so while they may or may not adapt those things into their training directly, maybe they'll encounter a dog where that method might be a better way to teach that particular exercise. Mm-hmm. And so I think the biggest thing is in the sports, the protection sports I've been doing, is if you show that you can control your dog, so you have the obedience side of part of the down and the impulse control part of the down, and you can keep your decoy safe, that most decoys and helpers are willing to do whatever you really want them to do within reason, right? They're not going to do anything that's unfair to the dog or not clear. But if you show that you have that knowledge and you have put the time and work into the foundation and you have this training plan that you put a lot of thought into, they are generally pretty respectful about it. Yeah. As far as the outside world and other sports, you know, I think it's just a matter of them not really understanding the amount of control and obedience part of it that goes into it. So the bite work phase is just one phase of all these sports. For IPO, it's just one of three phases. You have to do tracking and obedience too. And within the bite work phase, there is a ton of secondary obedience. It's not like our dogs are just going out willy-nilly biting, right? And that we can't get them out. There's so much control that goes into it. Yeah. And I think that when people actually start looking at the sport, they start to see how much of it is under the surface, other than those bitey videos that we all post, the flashy ones. Yeah. But it's the same with any sport, right? Because agility is the same, right? Oh yeah, I just run around the course, my dog runs next to me and we do the thing and the dog does the thing. And you're like, yeah, but no, because dogs run faster than us. And then they always like tunnels better than the jumps. And they, you know, like.
Tunnels are the same in Hoopers. We have the same problem with tunnels in Hoopers.
Yeah. And there's, you know, a start line stay, and sometimes I have to do crosses and all of these other things that you don't think about when you just first glance at it. Or like nose work, right? People are like, well, nose work, you just teach your dog to find the search. Well, yeah, but also it could be an accessible hide, or what if they can't reach the hide, or what if there's a distraction present, like what if there's competing smells, like there's so many other things that go into it.
Yeah.
And on top of that, handler nerves, like,
right.
So I think it's the same for that. And one of my favorite things ever is to, like, when I teach seminars and workshops, you know, there's always somebody, well, can you bring creature out? And we want to watch them work at the end of the thing. I'm like, oh, heck yes. So this is an opportunity to show the amount of control I have on this dog, and show that it's possible to do this. And if I can do this level of control with a dog that naturally wants to do this and that's been bred for generations upon generations to do this thing, that we're in it together and he, you know, it's a team sport, then why can't we do the same with any of our other sports, right? Yeah. So I think that's the thing, is that typically the people that aren't a huge fan of it. And yeah, there are bad trainers on both sides of the coin. There's bad R plus trainers that do protection sports, and there's bad balance trainers or really heavy handed trainers as well, that aren't clear to the dogs, or they're just pushing it too extreme as far as what methods they're using. But that's the same as every sport. And so it shouldn't be that protection sports are labeled for that. Because I would like to say, at least here in the United States, the trend is more towards motivational based for the balance trainers versus the other direction. So
yeah. I think the other thing is as well, is that, again, as you say, people only see the bitey side of things. The other thing people really don't seem to understand is that if the dog does not have a really good sound temperament, they're not going to do well at that sport.
Right.
Why I didn't go down that road with Dodge, because he does not have the temperament for it. I had a discussion with two trainers that I really know and respect, and they both went, don't even attempt to open that can of worms, because you will never put the genie back in the bottle. Don't do it.
Right.
So he didn't, you know. Yeah, he's got a little cushion that he carries around and stuff, but would I even put him on a sleeve? No, because I don't want him to ever think that people are an option of teeth, ever.
Right. And so there's some argument with that too, though, because there's different drives that we work in. So Mondeo Ring, you can do the sport 100% in prey drive, and so then it's just a big game of tug, right? A wrestling game of tug.
Yeah.
And then there is like IGP and PSA, where we want the dogs in a more defensive type of drive. And we want the dog really thinking they're fighting for their life or their handler's life, or in that defending mode.
Mm-hmm.
And so for creature, his breeder pushed a lot for with the dogs he kept. So not necessarily creature, because he did have a different temperament than the two that he kept, but he wanted them more in the defensive mode for their foundation work, because it improved grip and improved confidence for this line of dogs. I never 100% never, ever, ever would go down that route with creature, because he doesn't need to be told that he is powerful. He knows he is powerful. His favorite thing is to try to bully people. This is why he's not a safe dog. But in bite work for Mondeo Ring, he only ever worked in prey drive. There was never a point where we put pressure on him where he thought he was fighting for his life, or that he had to scare the decoy to get the decoy to back down. Like, that was just not a method we used for him. And it very, very well could go wrong if in his real day-to-day life, if we had chosen to go that route.
Yeah.
Versus Famous, she is an underconfident dog. So where a creature is too confident, and like his ego needs to be taken down a few notches, to be honest, in that regard, Famous is underconfident, and she's more bark, bark, bark. And I highly doubt she would ever actually bite anybody unless she was fully cornered. She was taught bite work in defense as a young puppy in her foundation. So she learned that she's big, bad, and tough. And that scared the decoy away and got her the bite and everything else. And so we actually were able to build her her grip a little bit better with that. But unfortunately, the helper I was using didn't fully see it through. And then I ended up with some confidence issues still that we were able to counter with some prey work as well. But so there's different drives that we can work in based on the dog strengths. But yeah, there would be no way. If creature would have done IGP and I was in the wrong club that pushed for defense work, that would have been a train wreck. And that's the most common way that like IGP people want their dog's foundation. They want to see that real dog underneath, because IGP is a breedability program. And so they want to see that the dog can do it and still regain control after that.
And I think the other thing, because I don't know what it's like in the States at the moment, but in the UK, we are inundated with Malinois that are just being produced willy-nilly. There doesn't seem to be like any thought. It's just like, oh, I've got Mali, let's put them together and make babies, yay.
It's the same here right now.
People like literally I could put a post on Facebook now and go, I'm looking for an adolescent male Malinois, and I probably have about 50 within an hour going, this one. Obviously, I'm not taking in any adolescent males ever. Yeah. I'm never having another boy dog. Don't just put me off. I'm having girls forevermore. But it's so frustrating, because I feel as a breed, they are being really let down, because yes, they can be a cool pet if you've got them from the right lines to be a pet dog. My best friend's got an amazing one that lives at home with kids and is wicked. She lives in the house of other dogs and she's cool. That's not always the situation for friends I know that have sport mallies. They don't always live in the house with the other dogs. But you just, a lot more control and management of just in the world has to be in place, doesn't it? Like with you saying creature wearing a muzzle and stuff. I mean, do you have all 10 in the house, or do you have like some kennels so they have downtime as well? Or what's your kind of setup for that sort
of thing? So kind of circling back to the different lines of Malinois, right? Yes. So typically when people are looking for Malinois, I always say, make sure that the parents and the grandparents are doing the thing you want the dog to do. Because like, so I got creature because I wanted to be successful in Mondeering with a high drive, high intense dog. Mm-hmm. Who loves to fight. That was my goal with him.
I mean, the Mondio ones tend to be a little bit crazier, I feel.
Yeah. I mean, Mondio is based on like environmental stability and generalization of training. And so, yeah, they tend to be just very intense and very confident dogs that are what we're looking for. Yeah. But also they have to love to fight, because the decoy is putting a lot of pressure on that dog and trying to get that dog off of the bite. And so they have to really, really enjoy that aspect. And so for that reason, like I mentioned before, creature is always looking for a fight. Like he will 100%, he can go for hikes with dogs, be off leash with dogs, whatever. But if there is a reason they bump into him and he takes offense, like he's going to be like, it's on. That's it. That's on. Like he's not one of reasonable. Those.
He's a bit of a jock. Like he's a bit of a like.
Yes.
I'm gonna show him.
Mm-hmm. And so at that point,
picnic, and he's like, "No, I'm gonna tell."
No. Yeah, exactly. He's just not. Yeah, he is that boy. And so for that reason, he's not in the house with other dogs, because again, I've got 10 high drive, fast moving dogs who are reckless with their bodies, and sometimes they bump into each other. Mm-hmm. And just for that reason, even when he was younger, I always knew that he was not going to be integrated fully into our house. And so he spent this first year and a half crating and rotating and out with select dogs. And then after that, we just decided kind of run situation, and he's perfectly happy with that. Like he is not a spinner or a barker or anything like that. He just chills. He's got a great off switch, thank goodness. And that's just, he goes everywhere with me in his crate in the van, and we run errands together and we do a lot of things together, but he is not in the house. And then same with Famous. She was in the house until I think she was 4, but she became, she was same-sex aggressive. And so we did a kind of a crate and rotate management situation until it just wasn't safe anymore. She was jumping baby gates. And so I wasn't going to take the risk anymore. And so she is now in a kennel run next to creature, and they are the cutest ever. They like give kisses between the gate. Yeah, it's super cute. But yeah, so other than that, I do have some groups now because the dogs are older. And so the old dogs don't appreciate the young dogs' energy. And so we do rotate that way. But they're all pretty content.
I mean, even with the three, we have kind of segregation in the house. If I'm out or if I'm like going upstairs for a period of time, whatever, and I'm not around supervised, Dodge is separate from the girls because it's just safety.
It's just safety. Yeah.
If and when a new one appears, there will be more separation. And I totally understand with you, especially with the number of dogs you have. Yes, you can crate and rotate them, but you have to, if management fails.
When management fails.
Exactly that. It's not even an if, is it? It is a when, because it's going to happen that one day, that one time, like someone's just not going to shut that baby gate properly. Or as you say, the dog decides the baby gate's technically not high enough and being over it, and it's easy. It's keeping everyone safe. But also I do wonder sometimes with multi-dog households, whether it's better for us to kind of put in those segregations ourselves, because it just takes the pressure off the dogs for needing to feel like they have to.
Exactly. And that's kind of why I do it. I like right now that if my groups got together because of a failed baby gate, odds are nobody's going to take offense to it because they don't have grudges against one another. Mm-hmm. They might have had grudges years ago, but because we've done this and they've passed each other enough times during rotations and stuff like that, and accidental, oop, you're in the potty yard, okay, type of situations, that it's not a big deal to them. They still live in the same house. They still see each other. They, you know, are just separated by a barrier. Mm-hmm. So they're not ever in the situation where they're picking fights and they don't have those feelings of resentment building up. And so for me, having the dogs I've had and having the relationships between my dogs I've had, I've just found that's a better way for me to manage. I'm not as worried. I know that if an accident does happen, it's not a big deal. And I know that I'll likely be able to break it up with just my voice, because again, they don't have those grudges or anything built up. And so even with like Creature, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, like 6 barriers between him and like where I am right now. Mm-hmm. And like there's so many safety measures in place to get to latch systems, stuff like that in place, just because I know there is a potential there for if something does happen, management does fail, that it would not be a situation that would be a safe one. Mm-hmm. So
so with Creature, is he, don't mind me asking, is it a case of he has like his family and there's people within his inner circle which he's cool with, and then if you are not within the circle you should just not be near him?
Right, so he is 100% fine with anybody as long as I'm there and I'm monitoring that. He is not a go pet him situation. Like even me, when he was, I wasn't able to fully pet him and interact with him without him trying to instigate issues until he's probably about a year and a half old now. Now, like he can cuddle on my lap and we're great and everything else, but everything was an escalation. Trying to do nails was an escalation. And it took me that long to finally break through to him that I'm not here as a sparring partner, buddy. Like this is not what this is. This is, we're a partnership and that's,
we are a team.
Right. Right. And it took a lot of work to get him to that point, but he's great about that now. So for that reason, he likes my husband. Mm-hmm. And I would say that's about it. I think he likes his decoys. And I think if I allowed interaction between them, it would probably be safe. And he'd probably appreciate pets from him. But he's just not a dog that likes to be pet very much anyway. And so it's just, again, not a situation. But like I said, I can put him in a down stay by anybody. They can stare him down. They can do whatever they want. And he's just going to be like, I'm in a down. This is just another proofing exercise. And he'd be fine there. But he's not a dog that I would put in a social situation ever. It's not a, he's loose with people type of a situation.
No, but I really appreciate that honesty, because I feel like sometimes as trainers, like this pressure, I don't know if it's a society pressure, but like your dog should be perfect, you know, your dog should be able to deal with all these situations. And you know, I've been so lucky with all my girls that they were very people social. I would say all of my dogs are normally dog selective, in that if a dog's polite they'll say hi, if a dog's rude they'll tell them off. I think that's perfectly acceptable, and everyone needs to get over the whole, oh, your dog snapped at mine. It's just communication, people.
Right. Yeah.
Just that normal for a minute.
And I feel like social media is a big deal on that too. As long as I'm able to keep everybody safe, I feel like that's the most important part of it, and knowing my dog. But a lot of people don't know their dogs either. You know, you got rose tinted glasses that, no, my dog's totally friendly. And you're like, your dog is waiting for a reason here, buddy. No. So I think a part of it's that. I think in the breeding world, there's a lot of pressure to have perfect dogs. And I mean, I've listed 5,000 reasons why Creature will never, ever, ever be bred, because he's not an appropriate dog to carry on any sort of lineage. I don't care how great his lines are. I don't care what his accomplishments are. The fact that, you know, he has so many safety guidelines in place should be a big warning sign.
Yeah.
But I could see somebody who wanted desperately to breed him being covering that stuff up and maybe pushing him further than I'm willing to push him far as that stuff goes. So I think adding that layer of pressure on is a big one. But even like with my coolies, I've got a breeding program with them. I'm brutally honest about their flaws and what I think their strengths are and what I would improve on if I could. So I think that's a big thing. And it's hard with social media trying to be honest without people coming after you as well. So it's really hard to sit there and say, you know, Creature has flaws. He's not social. And they're like, well, why do you have him? Well, because honestly, I couldn't rehome him now if I tried.
I mean, you two as a team are epic. I mean, I've watched like your trial rounds. I've like watched all the fun things you've been doing with his retrieves and stuff. And you can tell that you two are just such a wicked team, and I love it. And I feel like I can kind of draw similarities with Dodge, because honestly, like, who the hell would I rehome him to?
Yeah.
Like who would have him? But I would not have a clear conscience to just give him into the world. And you know, I mean, even I'm always really honest with him about him, that if he wasn't with me, he might not be on this planet right now, because I think he would have bitten someone properly, and it would have caused damage, and it would have been a bad situation.
Right.
Not necessarily his fault, it's just he's that sort of dog. And I feel like we're kind of in that same boat a little bit.
Genetics
are waving like, hey.
Right. And like I really want to sit down with some BMOD trainers and really discuss, like, you know, training that we're putting in, to me is just more management skills. Like me putting obedience on Creature and making sure that he chooses to look at me when there's something that he'd rather be fighting, and all of these things, doesn't make him a dog that appreciates being social. Like, he's never going to be that dog's like, yeah, please pet me. Like, that's just not who he is. And so, like, at some point, like, if I am not on him 110% and aware of everything that's going on around us when he's out, like, that doesn't change what would happen if there was a situation, because of who he is. Yeah. And so, you know, everybody talks about, well, you should train your dog and not just rely on management. And it's like, okay, but training is a form of management at some point, because genetics are really what's there. And I can move that genetic needle down the spectrum as much as I can, but it's never going to go past what his DNA allows it to go. And so I don't know. It's always a weird argument for me.
Oh my God, it's so refreshing to hear someone else say this. I'm like, yes, all of this. I mean, I had it on, like, I did a stupid TikTok with Dodge. It was the Pink song, like, I love you, but I hate you and you're a dick, basically. And someone commented, well, when are you going to train him? And I was
it's not training.
What part of your genetics would you like me to train, sir?
And my favorite part is people who have seen Creature and I work that have not seen some of the issues. But like, if I go to a visiting club and, you know, I'm training them at some seminar or whatever, they would never suspect that, you know. And in the protection dog world, it is not commonplace to pet each other's dogs. Like, we don't just have dogs hanging out. Like, that's not the thing. Mm-hmm. And so, like, for everybody, that's normal. Oh, yep, they worked and they went back in the van. Like, that's the way it goes.
Circling and back so, to that sport thing.
Right.
I'm assuming at a Mondio trial, like, the dogs are put away and they're separate and no one's wanting to come and like give your dog a snog in the face at the end of
the night. No, unless you're inviting it or your dog is known to be a social dog, like it just doesn't happen. There's a big, like, you can stand by dogs all the time, but nobody's going to reach and pet the dog without knowing the dog. Like, it's just the dogs that are doing the sport are more at risk for not being social. And again, they're probably perfectly safe standing there. And they probably, if you did touch them, probably wouldn't care, but it's not something that they're seeking out. Like, you know, a lab wants to be pet by everybody. My coolies I breed for overly social, probably to compensate for the Malinois I have.
The coolies, like my chihuahuas will literally climb up a nostril if they can get away with it. Like,
exactly.
They do.
Our biggest issue with the coolies is keeping them from saying hi to the judge. Like,
right. Yeah. You're like, no, can you not? Okay.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, whatever. Incoming. My favorite is like every time we have all the coolies, we just yell like, incoming across the field as the dog is booking it to go say hi to somebody.
Whereas like Dodge was the opposite. I was like, okay, don't go near the judge. Just avoid the judge. The judge is going to stand there.
Judge is just there.
And this is one of the things that, you know, I had to work with him on, because I'm sure you've been hearing like freaking this term lockdown puppies. Like, it wasn't a fucking excuse for your dog to be an asshole. You know?
Yeah, but my lockdown puppy
missed out a massive chunk of socialization at shows.
Right. Yes, exactly. So that's where I'm at with Vibrant right now in her arousal issues. Loud handlers that are like tunnel, 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 you know, those type of handlers, they get her off the charts as far as arousal goes. So I have to do a lot of management for that. Mm-hmm. And it's so funny because Cake is not that way at all. She doesn't care. She is zen dog until you get the toys out, until you start working with her, then she amps up. Mm-hmm. And so, so for them
involved in the background.
No, the husband just came in. Oh, and so the dogs are like, oh, hey. But so for Cake, she could have been just fine as a COVID puppy because she didn't need that exposure of other people running their dogs. But Vibrant absolutely needed that. And I went to Ring Rentals. We went to Ring Rentals at least once a week when she was growing up through COVID. Yeah. And she was born October 1st, 2020. But we were the only ones in the building. So environmentally, she is solid, but she is not used to, she just never had that exposure, that socialization to experience and to be able to lower her arousal when other people were working their dogs. Like, it just never happened in her foundation. It matters for some dogs. And yeah, other dogs, Cake would have been just fine without that exposure.
Whereas like with Dodge, it was that whole, right, this person is going to be in the ring with us. Mm-hmm. And you just have to run past them and ignore them. And you said, we call it, he actually, when he's on a run, I will literally shout, quit lollygagging at him because he's like, there's something over. And I'm like, quit lollygagging. He goes, oh, yeah, sorry, I meant to be doing my job, aren't I? Sorry, mom. I just needed to look over there because I'm a shepherd and I had to just check that there was no imminent mortal peril. And I'm like, dude, we're at a show. There's no mortal peril. You will be fine. But I remember one day there was a new judge and I'd watched her judging some other people, and she judges agility more than Hooper. So she walks around quite a lot. Hooper's judges, like, we sit in chairs. The whole sport is just lazy. We stand still and handle our dogs. We sit in chairs to judge. Like, it's the laziest dog sport and I'm living for it. But because she's used to judging agility, she's used to having to move to check the contacts, blah, blah, blah. And when I went in the ring, I had to say to her, I was like, Elaine, can you please stand still when he's running? Because if you start moving around, like, I can't say that he's not going to decide that actually he's going to do his own version of a bark and hold. Not that he's ever been trained to do that, but I'm sure in his brain, genetically, there is a version there that he will pull out of his box of tricks just to terrify the poor judge. And he was cool and like stood still, but a few times I've had to kind of say to the judge, look, would it be possible for you to just stand somewhere slightly different?
Right.
But also the opposite, where if he really knows the judge and there's a lot going on in the other ring, the judge has actually stood between him and the other ring as almost a barrier to kind of go, I'm stood here and it's fine. He's like, oh, okay then.
Okay.
But that was something that I found hard, because when we first started competing, we were still in like little COVID bubbles. So we got to a show and there were five other dogs, which was cool. You know, when you've got a dog that needs space, like, wicked.
Yep.
And then the first big show, there was all of a sudden like 100, and it was like,
dogs everywhere.
Where did all the stuff happen? Now, you know, I could argue that maybe he was slightly flooded with that.
Yeah. Yeah. But you can't really avoid that situation. Right.
I'm assuming though, with going back to Creature, because he's that bit older, you just kind of had a break with COVID and competitions and then got back to it when everything opened up. But with your younger ones, have you found it has impacted the training? Or
So for Creature with Mondio Ring, like, we just kept training because it was an outdoor sport with very few people. And so we just kept our distance and it worked out really well. Yep. And so even trials, like, the most you have are like 20 people there. And so, and there's always plenty of space. So we adapted for it, which we were very lucky for. Yeah. But yeah, like I said, with Vibrin is the biggest one, and her inability to really manage her arousal when other dogs are running is the biggest issue. And we're working through it. Like, don't get me wrong, we are working through it and she's definitely improving. But man, of all of my dogs, she would have been the biggest one to benefit from growing up in that situation versus hitting it 2 years later, you know? It would have been a big benefit. And Cake totally would have been fine in that situation because of who she is genetically.
And so this again goes back to the genetics of the dogs. Is it a case of, because Vibrant missed out on some of that stuff just because that's how the world was at that time? Or do you think that her genetic makeup kind of added onto that, that it sort of amplified that situation even more?
Yeah, it's definitely her genetic makeup. So she has a lack of ability to manage her arousal anyway. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, who she is, then she's looking for an excuse to just amp up, right? And so that excuse is the form of other dogs running or loud handlers running. And then Cake genetically is just more of a zen chill dog. Like, her default is just kind of stand there and be like, yeah, cool, you're being crazy, that's fine. Impress me with something else. And so for her, like, it just wouldn't have been as big of an issue. Yeah. Maybe it would have been, had some sort of impact, but I definitely wouldn't be still struggling with it. Still working on it.
It's still a little bit of a hill you have to get over.
Oh, it's definitely still a hill, but it's not a mountain anymore. Not a molehill either, just a hill. But it definitely wouldn't still have an impact on our daily training if she would have had more of a foundation in it. And I was able to attack it head on when she was a younger puppy and more easily molded at that age. It still probably would have been a thing, but not nearly as ingrained and as practiced as it is now. So
with your sport dogs, do they kind of have a day off, or do you give them kind of rest periods? Do you kind of work them through, like, do they have like a summer season, then a few months off, and then a winter season, or do they kind of work year round? How do you kind of work your guys?
So right now I can't say that I have anything really on purpose or planned, just because of the young child.
Obviously you have just had a youngling as well, so that I'm assuming put a whole spanner in the works.
But when we were, you know, when we had our careers at Purina and the dogs were working every day, they definitely would have 2 days off a week, and so those would be my 2 days off each week. And on those days we might do off leash hikes or whatever if I felt like the dog still needed to get some of that energy out, but it wouldn't be anything training wise. We wouldn't have training sessions, because during the week they would have one session of training or teaching, so one thoughtful session, and that would probably be mostly with food or teaching a new freestyle sequence or something along those lines, or like weaves or whatever. And then one session of physical, so that might be like chuck it up a hill, so they're working on their fitness, or it might be swimming or whatever it might be. And then one just be a dog session, so that could be the off leash hike, or maybe we're going to just go sniff for treats or whatever it might be if it's rainy. And so they had three sessions a day at the minimum, and if I was working on a particular behavior that we needed to get taught, then it might be four or five sessions a day, just shorter ones for the learning process. And then the 2 days off from that. But I tried to cross train as much as possible, because again, repetitive movement is going to be more detrimental. And so all my Frisbee dogs learned agility, they learned diving, they learned scent work, they learned, you know, joring, whatever else I could do with them, so that they weren't just using the same muscles over and over again. And then even now, Vibrant's main sport is agility, but she does diving as well, she does scent work as well, she does joring as well, and she does disc as well. And so that's just, again, to give her some other things to train. And then Creature is the one, when he is prepping for trial, he gets worked 3 times a day. One of those sessions is a bitey session. So whether it's biting on a pillow or my leg, depending on what it is.
I'm assuming that's right. Wearing a suit when you say that, and he's not yeah. randomly hanging off your calf muscle.
Yeah, right. Not hanging off my actual leg. That's important.
But you're going to go for a lot of UGG boots if you do it that way, I'm just going to say.
Yeah, once a day. Oh my God. And that's to help strengthen his jaw and his neck, because those are the things preventing injury for him in bite work in that sport. And then one obedience session a day, and then one strength training, whatever it might be. And mostly it's just jumps at this point for him. And so he needs those 3 sessions a day.
Yeah.
And he typically does not get a day off if we are trial prepping. Mm-hmm. I just decrease the intensity of what we're working on a couple of those sessions.
Okay. Obviously, again, it's dog dependent, isn't it? And with the sport you're doing, because I understand totally, you know, you need his muscles to work and stuff, because when you're doing, I think Mondio from the outside doesn't necessarily look like the most physical.
Oh, it's horribly physical. Oh, but, yeah, no. Oh my God.
Oh my God. Like for me, the heel work, the obedience stuff,
mm-hmm.
the amount of physical control the dogs need to stay in that beautiful heel position. And I mean, with Mondio, is the head carriage quite high, or is it a bit more neutral?
So the big thing with Mondio is you're out there for a Mondio Ring Level 3 program is a minimum of 40 minutes that your dog is in working mode and on the field. And so that it's an endurance game. And for that reason, you're not judged on the heel position. You just have to have a consistent heel. Okay. I go for a heads up heel because it helps my dog stay consistent. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot to it. The other physical thing is the jumps. The jumps are insane. For full points at level 3, they have to clear a 1.3 meter hurdle. The long jump is 4.5 meters or 4 meters. I don't remember. I hate the long jump.
That's a lot.
And then the palisade, which is the wall that they have to climb, is 2.3 meters tall.
Wow.
And so
that's
just
7 foot in English money. So that's, for most people kind of listening, that's like your average ceiling height in a house is 7 foot.
Yeah. It's a lot. And then all of the bite work. So you do your obedience, then you do your jumps, and then you do your bite work, and then you get judged on if your dog lets go on the bite, and like their intensity still has to be just as high. And that's where all the exertion comes out, is in the bite work itself. Yeah. So it's the length of the program in Mondio.
It makes sense why he has to have that level of fitness to be able to do that sport. It's not a weekend sport, is it?
No. Oh God, no, no. And that's why I'm like, oh man, we have to start prepping for Mondio again. It's like, do I want to dedicate 3 sessions? And for him, it's a mental strategy as well.
Yeah.
If he doesn't get his bite work outlet, then he tends to get frustrated in his training. Mm-hmm. And then that comes out in bad ways. And so for him, I have found that he needs to have bite work every single day leading up to a trial. Otherwise, it's just going to be frustration nightmare. And maybe, who knows, maybe the season will be different. I say, as like a prisoner to my own training.
You're like, why did I come up with this training regime?
I know. Oh, why do I have the dog I have? I love him so much. But oh,
remember, he's going towards elder, so maybe he'll calm down. Yeah, I'm lying as I'm saying it. I'm sorry.
He's older now. He's wiser.
And I actually said wiser, not calmer.
No, he's not calmer.
So for anyone that's kind of in sports and listening, what's your kind of pre-game for you mentally? Because that's one of the things I found for me. Like, I like to know the venue. If we compete, like this winter series, we've been competing at the same venue all winter, which has been brilliant. So for Dodge, it's become a lot more of a pattern. So he's like, oh, we park our van here. And because I get judge ring party parking, we're always in the same spot, which is cool. So he's like, so we go from the van and then we go to this bit and I pee over here and then we warm up here and then I go in the ring and then we go back to the van and then I chill for a bit. So it becomes a pattern. When we're kind of at new places, for me, I feel like the patterns are as important for me as they are for him. I feel like both of us, as I said, we're each other's emotional support creatures. But for people that are maybe kind of in sports and find themselves like, I don't know, getting a bit nervous or stressy, or the other way around, like, what's your kind of advice? What are your like little tips and tricks of things you do?
Yeah. So for me, it really depends on my dog and the sport we're doing. I like to be close enough to the ring before our turn that I can see what's going on, but not so close that I am like, we are at the ring ready to go, because I tend to amp myself up. And so that's a big mental health strategy, is just to stay far enough away that I'm not getting my dog amped up or hold on, I'm plugging in my computer.
You're cool. You're fine. I was like, oh, the computer's moved. She's got a plug in. Battery's going. I got you.
I was taking advantage of the husband being here. And I'm like, hey, there's my power cord. Can you grab that? And we're all good now.
Thank you, husband.
She said, thank you, husband.
So that's a big podcast. Thank you.
So that's the big thing is knowing where do I want to be just before we go into the ring. And then I kind of back chain from there. So it also depends on my dog and what they need as well. So Famous, for agility, I know she needed a lot of acclimation time to the space, but not active working or warm up time. So she couldn't be working in that moment, but she needed to be taking in the space around her. And so for her, we would go find a corner near the ring and we just lay down and she'd cuddle in my lap and she'd take in the ring. And this is my Malinois. She is just in my lap. And that's what we did. And we had done our warm up before that so that she wasn't going into the ring cold. But if I spent that time before getting in the ring, warming her up and demanding her focus, when she hit the ring, she would be burnt out and just nervous. Yeah. And so found that strategy worked best for her. Versus on the other hand, Creature, he does best when he is 100% with me all the way to the field, from the van to the field. So he gets potty before I make sure that he's ready to go. And then when it's our time to go, it's working mode from the second I put my hand on that crate, and we have a whole pattern that we do to get us there. And each point I'm asking him, are you with me? Are you paying attention? Are you ready? Where's your arousal at? And he's answering those with the behaviors he's offering me.
Yeah.
But as far as mental health stuff or mental strategy goes, at some point I just realized that nobody remembers your round. Like nobody remembers it, but they remember your attitude. So if you are happy and having fun, that's what they're going to remember regardless of what your dog did. And so every time I hit that ring, I try to be happy and having fun. And if a mistake happens, I handle it the way I want to, true to my training. And we kind of, and not caring if somebody thinks I'm doing too many chin rests or whatever it might be, and kind of go from there. So I think that was the biggest thing as far as being mentally prepared. The other thing that I like to do if I feel nervous, which happens, is I do mindful meditation. I know it sounds space agey, but oh my goodness, it was a game changer for me, man. Counting and breathing, controlling your breathing and focusing on your body and all of that stuff, huge, huge help. And so that just helps limit the nerves going down to my dog.
Yeah, no, I think that's all like really good advice, and especially the bit of people don't remember your round, but they remember your attitude. I can definitely, like, even when I'm judging, like there are teams that come in where I know that the dog's maybe just going to goof around a bit and be like a bit of a knob.
Yeah.
But they're having fun together and that's cool. Right. And one of my favorite handlers to watch, and I'm going to give Sam a shout out, because regardless of what her dog does, even if they like come off the line or they get the line wrong or whatever, she always tells the dog that they're amazing and they're the best ever. And I kind of try, and I've started trying to channel that into me a little bit with him. You know, if something goes wrong, I'm like, good job, buddy. I mean, sometimes I'm like, donkey, what did you do that for? And he's like, oh yeah, sorry, we were meant to do the other thing, weren't we? I was like, I gave you a cue. And he's like, well, I kind of heard it, but I decided that I knew a better route to go.
Right.
But I was just going to ignore that cue that you've just been practicing for the last 2 years. You know, it wasn't a thing today. But then there's other times where I mess up my cues and he literally gets me out of Dodge. Like he lives up to his name and he's like, oh, he means this way. And just does it. And I'm like, there's times where I've literally stood in the ring and gone that way, which isn't even a cue,
right?
He's like, and I hear the eye roll. I mean, one of the things with me doing these start line weight dance stupid proofing things I'm doing, it's like this is my challenge this year. Every week there's a new start line weight dance.
I love it,
and everyone's joking that like he's either going to start breaking his weights if I don't do it, or he's just not going to start unless I do a dog. And I've got a horrible feeling that by the end of the year, I'm going to get in the ring, set him up, go in the middle and go to release him. And he's going to be like, where's the show, princess?
Yeah, exactly.
And I'm
going to be like,
shit. I'm just hoping some of the show managers put some good music on so I can at least have a little boogie before I start. But I almost feel like I'm making a cross my own back. But do you know what? If my dog's not going to break his weight until I literally do Running Man in the middle of the ring,
then you're going to do it.
I'll go with that.
Exactly.
There are worse problems to have in dog sports, right?
Yes, 100%. Absolutely.
So, Sarah, for people that maybe want to train with you, now you do a lot of stuff with Fenzi Academy, so they can do online stuff, which is how I came across you in the first place. If people want to find you, do stuff with you, follow you, where can they do that?
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, Fenzi Dog Sport Academy is where most of my classes are at. I also have a couple kind of on-demand classes through Consider the Dog, as well as my Facebook training group. So I have the Zoom Dog Life, and that's, it's a paid to enter group or just one time fee. And then I post random things that we are working on with my dogs. And then we do some train along. So right now we're actually doing a pet photography train along. So it's like a 4-week class on pet photography for people that asked for it. And I was like, sure, yeah, we can do that since that's my other thing.
And
I do.
I have to say, some of the pictures that I've seen you put up, I've been like, wow.
Yeah.
Like,
that's my, my little hobby there.
It's so, a very good hobby, I have to say. And all of your dogs seem very photogenic as well.
You know, that is a demand for working here. You guys have to be good looking.
So I've got to ask, when they're puppies, is that one of the first things you teach them is to pose?
No, actually, I don't. Like, my dogs don't learn stays at all. I just put them on things and I'm just like, stay on this thing. So they know like perch stays, like jump out on this thing. And they learn that. But man, like sit stays and down stays are one of the last things I teach my puppies. So we just kind of throw some treats and then run away, get in position and photograph when they come back.
I love it. Just lob the treats and get in position. This is the plan.
Yep.
I love that. I love the honesty of it. So I will put links on the show notes for where people can find you. So as always, guys, you can follow us on the socials, on the Facebook, the Insta and the TikTok, at Dodge Shepherd, at Means Chihuahua on Instagram if you want to follow what the dogs are doing. And remember, stay safe, be kind, wash your hands thoroughly, keep your dogs on lead around livestock, and don't let them lick toads. Take care, guys. Bye. I just wanted to ask you a real quick favor. If you could rate, review and subscribe to the podcast, it's going to help other people find me and listen to what I'm doing here at Canine Hoopers World. We're now on all the socials. So we have the Instagram, we have the Facebook, and we are officially on the TikTok at Canine Hoopers World. And remember to check out our website, www.caninehoopersworld.com, where you can find out information on in-person courses, online courses, and if you're doing Hoopers with your dog, you can also join in with our online achievement awards. These are open to any person, any dog, anywhere in the world to come and test your skills and get yourself a cool ribbon.